From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. A new center at the University of Northern Iowa seeks to inform Iowa school kids about the Holocaust and genocide. This hour, we'll find out about the center from its director, Stephen Gaze. We'll also talk with Adele Anolik. She's profiled concentration camp survivors who came to Des Moines. Anolik's husband survived the Nazi concentration camp in Dachau and eventually settled in Des Moines. Then in the second half hour, we'll get an update on the impacts that modern-day human trafficking have in Iowa and the efforts to stop it. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa has long been a haven for refugees from genocide and other humanitarian crises. The University of Northern Iowa has just launched a new center for Holocaust and genocide education. Its mission? To provide educational programming and resources to the state of Iowa and beyond. Joining me now to talk about the new center, the director of the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education at UNI, Stephen Gaze, a professor of English at the university. Good afternoon to you, Stephen.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Also joining us for this half hour to discuss the center and genocide, Adele Anolik. She is a resident of Windsor Heights and also the author of a book, The Liberation of the Concentration Camps, 1945, The Des Moines, Iowa Survivors, published by Ice Cube Press in 2008. Adele joins us by phone from her home in Windsor Heights. Good afternoon to you, Adele.
Hi. Nice to talk to you, I hope.
Oh, it will be a pleasant conversation.
I'm doing something I've never done before like that.
Very good, Adele. Hold on for a minute. I want to talk to Stephen about the new center before we get to you.
Okay.
Elaborate on the mission of this new center, Stephen. How does it and how it fits into UNI's larger mission in educating teachers?
Well, the center is picking up where an ad hoc committee had been working for more than 4 years to raise awareness and provide educational opportunities about the Holocaust and then other genocides on campus and off campus as much as possible in collaboration with civic organizations, museums, art centers, things of that like. We have a number of goals that are part of our mission. The first is to enhance undergraduate education at UNI in the area of the Holocaust and genocide. We also want to begin working with teachers and students in Iowa schools to promote in every way that we can and in every way that teachers feel that we can help them to make Holocaust and genocide education and all of the other issues that it raises priorities in Iowa's core curriculum.
Mm-hmm. And I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead, Adele.
Okay. My question is this. I'm really wondering, after all this time, what started up the idea that this is what you wanted to do?
Yeah, good question.
Restart Holocaust education, do you feel that there's a possibility that there's going to be a problem with more Holocausts? Of course, we know that there are constantly things going on all the time, but I'm curious.
Stephen Gaze.
Well, the credit belongs to a number of people. Perhaps first and foremost, the former dean of the College of Humanities and Fine Arts at UNI, who gave the initial impetus to the development of what was going to be a modest lecture series on the Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
but which quickly developed in early 2006 into a fairly ambitious program of concerts, exhibits, lectures, and other events designed to raise awareness about the Holocaust. I have to say that all along the way, we've had tremendous support both on and off campus.
Mm-hmm. Professor Gaze, also in Adele's question there too, is why, I think, why now?
Yeah,
what
why
is the
now?
What is the purpose over 65 years after the end of that horrible period, the Holocaust? I know you're dealing with other genocides. Why is it a pressing issue now that we raise awareness about genocide?
Well, I think the simple answer to that question is that we want to break the cycle of watching genocide and other human rights abuses take place and then lamenting our failure to have acted when it could have made a difference. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has a new motto right now, and I want to read it for you because I think it captures what we're going to try to do in every way possible in the state of Iowa.
Have you ever been there?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, me too.
And the museum says, and I'm quoting now, by remembering the Holocaust and other genocides, we bear witness to the past, and by learning from them, we create our best hope for a more just future.
Adele, I want to go to you now because in your collection, The Liberation of the Concentration Camps, 1945, the Des Moines, Iowa survivors, published a couple of years ago, you profile your husband, Charles.
Yes, my husband, Charles, who is now a Holocaust survivor, who always talked about the Holocaust.
He did. Now, tell us.
We'd go out to dinner. Mm-hmm. What do you think dinner conversation would be with everybody? The Holocaust.
He is a survivor of Dachau.
He was a survivor of Dachau, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He grew up in Lithuania.
He grew up in Lithuania, and he brought his mother over here to this country, and she didn't speak English, but she was speaking to people on the bus, and then she came to our home here.
Tell us a little bit about his story. At the end of the war in 1945, you recount in your book how he was put on a forced death march to the Bavarian Alps. He actually dug his own grave and would have been in it if not for the liberation of the Americans.
If the army hadn't come. That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly how it was.
What did your husband have to say, his thoughts about how he survived when millions, 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust?
Well, I have to tell you, of course, that he always talked about it to everybody. But he appreciated the fact that the American army was there when after they had dug their graves and in the morning before they were all killed, the survivors, why the American army was there and liberated them. But this was always on his mind, and, I mean, he let our children and our grandchildren, everybody knew about it, and he was a very gentle and a kind person, and all I can say is, I mean, he died about 2 years ago, and it's just like it was yesterday.
He was very willing to talk about the Holocaust. You interviewed a number of the survivors of the Holocaust in your book, all of which have now passed, Holocaust survivors who ended up settling in Des Moines.
The 15 of them that I interviewed and had their pictures taken and all and have all the information in my book, they're all gone.
Now, how were they all willing to talk about the Holocaust as your husband was?
No, they were not.
What other experiences did you have in interviewing them?
Well, I knew most of them because we were all going to the same synagogue, and or most of the ones we were all going to the synagogue. They were very friendly with me, and I knew the families, and that's just about it.
Now, what points do you think should be emphasized when teaching children in Iowa in their teens the mission of to help support this, the mission of the new UNI Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education? What points do you think should be emphasized in learning about genocide and the Holocaust?
Well, you know, that's what I'm actually beginning to wonder. I mean, is how we started up again. I mean, fortunately, to my knowledge at least, I can't recall other places. And my husband and I had friends over in Paris, and I have family. My husband had family in Israel, and the Israeli family calls me every second or third week, and I call them. And I don't know. I mean,
Well, let's get
in my mind. Yeah. It's to protect Israel from the Palestinians.
Let's talk to Stephen Gase about the mission. What will be emphasized? How early should children in Iowa start learning about the Holocaust and genocide?
Well,
this is
I
a question, Adele.
Early.
Just a moment, please. This is a question for Stephen Gase.
Yes. Okay.
Well, Ben, we didn't set the center up in order to tell teachers when and how they should teach the Holocaust. There may be a point at which we will be providing that kind of technical support. The first thing we're going to do, and this project is already underway, is to find out what teachers throughout the state of Iowa are currently doing and what they see as the benefits of teaching about these subjects and what problems and limitations they run into.
Do you have an idea, the answer to that question, what is currently being done in classrooms across Iowa?
I do have an answer, but the answer is based on anecdotal evidence. It's based on what I've heard teachers say when I've attended workshops with them on Holocaust education. It's based on what I've learned from students in my classes at UNI about their previous exposure to the Holocaust and genocide. What we want to do is to find out systematically what teachers need and what they want, and to start working from there.
As someone who has dedicated his studies as an English professor, at least in large part, to studying the Holocaust and education, Stephen Gase, what do you feel is an appropriate age to introduce this awful side of humanity?
Well, we know from all of the different states in which some kind of education about the Holocaust and, I might add, other genocides is mandated. There are, for example, 11 states out of the 50 that mandate some kind of teaching unit on the Armenian genocide, which is often referred to as the first genocide of the 20th century. We know that typically education begins in these areas around junior high school, middle school.
Mm-hmm.
More frequently, it's a subject that's given to high school students, but again, we're not starting out with any preconceptions or with any predetermined goal. We want to find out what's going on and how we can promote Holocaust and genocide education in the most effective way in Iowa.
Here's a question for both of you, and I'd like to start with Adele.
Can I just tell you one thing?
Sure.
I have to tell you, I play chess every Tuesday at Borders. I lose. I have to tell you, though, I lose to all the fellows there that play chess, but that's beside the point. But there is a family that comes there with two children that we all play, and the mother has asked me, I have a date to give a talk on the Holocaust in November in Ankeny, and I kind of hesitated for a minute because, I mean, the Holocaust is always a touchy subject. But anyway, so I agreed to do it. So that's what I'll tell you, and I'll be interested to see what the reaction is after that.
How, Adele, and then also to Professor Gase, how great is the fear among survivors that the Holocaust will fade from memory? Worse than fade from memory, perhaps there are people in this world who deny it, who revise it to be something else?
Well, there's always that. I mean, you think I haven't run into people that have denied the Holocaust?
To your face?
Yes, yeah. yes. That here in town, I can't remember anymore, and most of the, all of my Holocaust survivors in the first place are deceased now, the ones that I wrote about. Yes. Oh, there are people, and I have friends who hear from people in Europe that deny the Holocaust, and there are people here that do too. This is one of those things. I think that it's just one of those things. I don't know what else to say. I can't. Obviously, okay. They didn't have immediate family that went through it.
Stephen Gase, your answer to that. This must be also part of the mission of this new center here. not only not to forget, to make sure that we remember correctly with the documentation what exactly happened.
Absolutely. And I want to emphasize that denial is not unique to the Holocaust.
That's right.
It's an issue that continues to plague the Armenian genocide. It's also operating with regard to the Rwandan and Bosnian genocides of less than two decades ago. So it's a problem that we have to confront with almost every genocide that's taken place.
I'm sure that's true.
And I to go back to the question that you first put to Adele, I know that Holocaust survivors in this country and around the world consider it a sacred duty to help others remember the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. If I can just quote Elie Wiesel, who, of course, is for many people one of the faces of the Holocaust, he said a number of years ago, and again I'm quoting, "What does it mean to remember? It's to live in more than one world, to prevent the past from fading, and to call upon the future to remember it." And our mission is, to put it in the simplest way, not only to educate students about what happened, but to motivate them, to inspire them to act so that it doesn't happen again.
What issues, Professor?
I'll stop you a minute. Uh-huh. Elie Wiesel happens to be a friend of mine, and I have kept in touch with him through the years, and I used to see him at all the Holocaust meetings throughout the country. And I have here a very short thing in my book that says, "Please know that I was moved to read of the many years you devoted to documenting the tragedies of the Holocaust. Thank you for helping preserve memories with such a deep level of commitment." Elie Wiesel wrote this letter to me, and he wrote a beautiful letter for my husband before he passed away. You mentioned a friend of mine.
Right. And Adele, we do want to mention that for those who have just tuned in, you are the author of a 2008 Ice Cube Press book titled The Liberation of the Concentration Camps, 1945, The Des Moines, Iowa Survivors, and 15 survivors profiled in that book. Back to a question for Stephen Gaze.
Okay.
Which issues do you anticipate will be controversial in the approach of teaching the Holocaust and genocide to school children in Iowa?
Well, I think the first question will be, why devote valuable school time to these historical events? Along with that will be the perfectly legitimate question, how do we do this in the most efficient and effective way possible?
Mm-hmm.
And part of my response is that by teaching about the Holocaust and other genocides, we're taking some of the most extreme forms of social injustice and human rights abuses and opening students' eyes in dramatic ways to the whole range of issues that this generation may be uniquely prepared to tackle, given the ease with which we can communicate with one another, given the speed with which news travels. So we're going to promote Holocaust and genocide education because they're important and because we have to stop them, but also to raise awareness about the whole range of other issues, everything from rape and sexual violence to the use of child soldiers to the deprivation of basic human and social rights, and to try to make students active in creating a better world for their generation and their children's generation.
Adele Anolik, I wanted to go back to another profile. We talked briefly about your husband died a couple years ago, his profile in your book. Would you share another brief profile from your book? Do you have another one you can bring out of a Holocaust survivor who ended up in Des Moines? There was I remember reading the case of Phyllis and Irvin Karp of Poland.
The Karps, yeah. They're all deceased now, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit of their story?
Can you hold on a minute while I turn to the... Yeah, they were good friends of ours, Phyllis Karp and Irvin Karp. Yeah, I'll just tell you, Phyllis was born to parents Shmula and Zista Wittenberg, and there were six children in the family. And she met her husband Irvin in 1929. Actually, as I read this, basically there were pretty generous stories. Pretty much followed. I mean, there were problems in Poland, and in a number of the European countries. And then Linda Fishman, you know, Linda just died this past week.
Now, did
Linda Fishman? She was the last of the Holocaust survivors here
in the Des Moines area.
In the Des Moines area, yeah, and she just died, and she was right around my age, and she was born to parents. To parents Ghana and Yitzhak Riggerbacher. Mm-hmm. And she was very active here, and she had a son that just died in one of the southern states not too long ago, a 50-year-old son, and she has children out in California, and we just had the funeral here less than a week ago.
Now, I know on the cover of your book, on the back cover, I believe, you show the back cover of your book features a Holocaust memorial that is in the Des Moines area.
That's right. That's right. And that's at the cemetery at the here in it's a photo, the Jewish monument in the Des Moines, Iowa. It's at the cemetery where a good part of the Jewish people are buried. And the people who were running the state wanted it to go up to the Capitol building, to be on the grounds of the Capitol building.
Mm-hmm.
And the survivors had purchased the monument, and including my husband and the rest of the survivors, who were all friends. They wouldn't let it happen, so it's still out at the cemetery.
Stephen Gaze, I'm interested in specifically, I know you're in an early stage here developing, you want to get feedback from people, teachers, educators across Iowa. How can they give you feedback at this point? Can people reach out to you through a website, say, I'm interested in this type of education? What's the next step? How can we develop a relationship?
Absolutely. We are in the process of getting our office and website up and running. So for the time being, I would encourage anyone with an interest in what we're doing and anyone who'd like to collaborate with us to contact me at Gaies, G-A-I-E-S, at uni.edu. We're creating an external advisory board, citizens, community leaders, and everyone is welcome to participate in this if they're committed to what we're doing.
You're in Iowa City?
We're in Cedar Falls.
He's in Cedar Falls.
You're in Cedar Falls.
We have to go now, Adele. I want to thank you, Adele Anolik. Thank you for sharing your stories. Author of The Liberation of the Concentration Camps, 1945, The Des Moines, Iowa Survivors. It's been a short time. Thank you for joining us by phone from Windsor Heights, Adele.
And thank you for including me.
All right. Very good. Goodbye now, Adele.
Okay.
Stephen Gaze, director of the University of Northern Iowa Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education. Thank you, sir, for coming into our studio.
Thank you, Ben.
And when we come back, an update on the impacts that modern-day human trafficking have in Iowa and the efforts to stop it. When we continue, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us over the noon hour. Human trafficking is modern-day slavery. It's a condition suffered by some 17,000 foreign-born persons in the United States and an estimated 250,000 U.S.-born children. Worldwide, estimates rise to 27 million people victims of human trafficking. What exactly is human trafficking? To what extent does human trafficking exist in Iowa? And what is being done to stop it? Some of the questions we'll look at in this next half hour with my guests, Alex Orozco. He is the executive director of the Iowa-based Network Against Human Trafficking, and Denise Timmons, assistant attorney general at the Iowa Attorney General's Office, both joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Alex, I'd like to start with you. Tell us about this Iowa-based organization that you are the executive director of, Network Against Human Trafficking.
Well, the organization was founded in 2005. We have a mission to end human trafficking in all of its forms. We collaborate with different organizations, with state agencies, federal agencies, to address this problem. And we are a volunteer-based organization.
Mm-hmm. We hear this phrase, human trafficking, but many of us are not aware of what types of human trafficking are out there, what is happening in our very state. What is it?
Well, human trafficking is essentially slavery. As you mentioned earlier, it's a condition when somebody is forced into labor, into commercial sex. In the case of children, anybody, any minor involved in commercial sexual activity is considered to be a victim of human trafficking. Many times people may refer to cases where children are being subjected to this situation through pornography on the internet or sexual performances or adults who come from other countries, as you mentioned, and sometimes human trafficking is never mentioned or those cases are not mentioned as human trafficking. So people sometimes don't realize that when a case like this comes up, it's actually human trafficking.
Denise Timmons, you have prosecuted a number of human trafficking cases, but first of all, tell us, how widespread is human trafficking in Iowa?
Well, I don't think anyone can really answer that question at this point. There really hasn't been any studies done in the state, and I think, as Alex had mentioned, sometimes it's always not recognized for what it is. I can tell you that I myself have prosecuted two cases. I know of a few other cases through the criminal system within the state that have arisen. But I think there's no question that it's going on. I think a lot of the issue is how we identify it and how we address the problem.
Let's talk about that a little bit later. And tell us about one of the cases that you prosecuted was, I believe, the first case in Iowa after a 2006 state law passed. You were involved in a case in the Denison area. Are you at liberty to tell us about that, to take us through what happened there so that we get a clear image of, at least in this case, what the trafficking was about?
I can. It was a public trial, and so I can discuss the facts of it, and I'll give you a very shortened version of it because it's kind of a long story. But the basics is that there were two runaway girls, minors, from Nebraska, who ran away from a juvenile home, ended up running into the two defendants in the case. One is Marcia Ryan, one is Leonard Russell. The defendants took the girls in, provided drugs and alcohol, those types of thing, and then asked the girls to go on the road with them. You know, basically, we'll get you out of town. So the girls left Omaha, Nebraska with the two, drove across the state of Iowa, ended up in Davenport. On that trip, the girls were informed as to what their responsibilities were going to be, and what that meant was if they wanted to stay, they had to prostitute and they had to strip. In exchange for that, they would be given shelter, food, clothing, all of those types of things. So over a 10-day period, the girls stayed with these two individuals. They ended up in Davenport. They ended up in Rock Island, Illinois, and ultimately ended up in Denison. Throughout that time, there was prostitution that was occurring. The girls were taken to strip clubs. And again, they were provided drugs and alcohol throughout the experience. At one point when they were in Denison, one of the girls was taken from the hotel in Denison, drove to Sioux City, and the next morning placed on a bus to Washington, D.C., where she was supposed to hook up with a person that the defendant, Leonard Russell, knew because she was going to start prostituting out in D.C. Mm-hmm. Luckily for her, they were able to track down where that bus was, and the Washington, D.C. Human Trafficking Task Force was able to meet her at that bus and pull her off of that bus in D.C. before she met up with the individual she was supposed to meet there.
Leonard Russell now behind bars for how long?
He is. He was convicted for ongoing criminal conduct, which is a 25-year sentence. He was convicted of two counts of human trafficking, which were both 10-year sentences, and he was also convicted of two counts of pandering, which were 10-year sentences. The judge did run those sentences concurrent, but he is on a 25-year sentence at this time.
Give us an idea of the nature of testimony provided by these girls, 16 and 15 years old, about how they felt about what they were made to do in this case of human trafficking.
You know, it's interesting. One of the girls did not like the prostitution and didn't want to do that, but she could put up with the stripping. The other girl could deal with the stripping, but she didn't like the prostitution. These were two very messed up girls that had a lot of problems. And one of the girls even testified at trial that, you know, had the police not intervened, I'd probably still be with this guy this day. So it's not that we had violence going on in this case. Not that it doesn't happen. It happens quite often in these types of cases. But what we had was two very vulnerable teenagers who were wholly taken advantage of by these adults. Their testimony was consistent in the sense of what happened to them. But as I had said, you know, drugs and alcohol and lack of sleep was involved throughout this entire time. So we had, you know, their stories of, you know, they'd never been to Iowa before. One of them said, well, I think I was in a town that started with a D, and I think maybe we were staying at a hotel that had an 8 in it, like a Super 8. So it took a lot of work on the part of the DCI agent involved to try and track down and put their story together for them, so we had the evidence to corroborate it.
If you've just joined us, Exchange listeners, we're talking with Denise Timmons, Assistant Attorney General at the Iowa Attorney General's Office, and Alex Orozco, Executive Director of the Iowa-based Network Against Human Trafficking. Human trafficking, our topic for this half hour. If you'd like to join our conversation with a comment or a question about human trafficking, especially in Iowa, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Alex Orozco, you've heard many stories, many cases of human trafficking, I'm sure. Can you give us the story, another story that perhaps delivers another face of human trafficking so we can know what that's about?
Sure. There is one that happened very close to where I live, actually, here in Des Moines, and that never made it into the legal system as of yet because of the circumstances around it. But it involved a woman from Mexico that had been brought into the United States by her own siblings who lived here in Des Moines. And she was asked to work as a babysitter of about 20 children. And she was not able to communicate because she was deaf and couldn't speak in any type of sign language could communicate. And she was being physically abused by her siblings. At one point, she was raped by somebody and even had a child. And her situation was brought up to my attention by her neighbor, who happened to know me and knows of some of the community work that I do. And so we are trying to help this woman first to communicate, being able to assess how much she understands and have some kind of testimony, if possible, before anything else. So there are a couple of social service agencies, and the state of Iowa is involved in trying to help what happened to her.
Now, your group, Alex, was partly responsible for getting a state law passed in 2006 that allows for the enforcement of human trafficking provisions. What exactly did that law do?
Well, it has several components. First of all, and probably the most important, is that it creates human trafficking as a new crime on its own under the state code. It establishes punishment for traffickers. It also mandates training for law enforcement agencies in Iowa through the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy. Also provides for victim compensation funds, like victims of rape or domestic violence or other crimes are able to apply for. And there was another component I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. Now, a bill is working its way through Congress. Presently, I understand it's called the Trafficking Deterrence and Victim Support Act of 2009. What does this bill do that the state law didn't take care of?
Well, it has money. Currently, the state law does not provide for funds to provide direct services to victims and survivors of human trafficking, as well as other activities that are needed to properly address this problem, which is public awareness and further training for law enforcement and increase the tools the law enforcement would have available.
So we can help the victims more. For instance, Denise, what happened to the 15 and 16-year-old in that December 2008 case? Where are they now? Or have they been able to get help?
Well, both of them were sent back to the juvenile homes where they came from in Nebraska. One was able to get out fairly quickly to get home. The other was not, and is probably going to be, you know, a ward of the state until she's 18. No, I do not believe that they received the assistance they should, because just of the follow-up that I've done with them. When you're talking about human trafficking and these, it's a special set of issues, and if we don't have the resources and the education and people who are knowledgeable in this type of area, these victims are not getting the type of services and support and counseling that they need. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a big concern.
Looking at these statistics, 250,000 U.S.-born children affected by this, 17,000 foreign-born persons in the United States. This is a huge problem, and it seems like, am I stating this correctly, we have blinders on in our society up to this point.
We do. In fact, to give you a scope of how many of those estimated to be involved are actually found in or brought into the legal system to receive help and justice since 2005, when the U.S. government established task forces, regional task forces and working groups to address this problem. 1,038 children have been recovered and 571 convictions. So that's even less than 1% of the estimated number of children that are being trafficked.
Mm-hmm. It seems with these two primary types of human trafficking, the sex trafficking, the immigrant trafficking, do they need different solutions?
Well, yes, the thing is, like Denise mentioned, a problem takes different faces. You cannot say that one case occurs the same as the next one or the one after or before. So they all have individual circumstances and situations that have to be addressed and assessed according to that. So there's not one size fits at all in this problem.
Mm-hmm. Denise Timmons, can you comment on how the recent move to shut down Craigslist's adult services listings, how it helps or hurts the problem of human trafficking?
Well, I think that obviously the move to shut that down is a good move on the part of our society to do that. And for example, the Denison case, those girls were put on Craigslist. That's how they would be able to go from town to town and solicit the services. Is, you know, photos were taken of them and Craigslist was used in the erotic services. The problem is of course, these people are just going to move to some other venue. And I think we've already seen that. I know that some issues have come up now with, I think it's called Backpage, which is similar to Craigslist, and mm-hmm. It seems that everything has shifted over there. So, yes, I think it's absolutely the right move to take a stand against some of these people who are maybe complicitly helping traffickers find their demand. But I think the bottom line is, as long as we're going to have the demand for it, it's going to be out there, mm-hmm. Whether it's out in the public view or whether it's this can be a very underground business. So
right. You mentioned underground. There are some parts of the United States and many parts of Europe where it is not underground. What do you say to those who would suggest perhaps the legalization and regulation of prostitution would be a better way to attack human trafficking?
I understand the argument on that, and I have to admit, maybe years ago I may have somewhat have agreed with some of those arguments, but the more I have gotten into this, I completely disagree with it now. I understand that if it's out there, you can regulate it, you know what's going on, you can control it more, but you know what we know is the majority of women who end up in prostitution have been physically and sexually abused themselves. The majority of those women ending up, and I shouldn't say just women, but the majority of people ending up in prostitution start when they are children, when they're minors. That can't be acceptable in our society. And to legalize it and to say this is okay and for all of us to turn our heads to it, I think is just wrong.
Mm-hmm. But it would bring some more light to it and make sure that this wasn't happening to minors, those would say.
Well, those would say, but I guess maybe I'm jaded from being in criminal law as long as I have, but you know, the government can regulate it all they want, but it's still going to occur, you know, on the fringes and in ways that it should not be. So,
in terms of raising awareness and prevention, I'd like to get both of your views, that we have about 5 minutes left in our conversation, about the misconceptions that the general public may have, general public not aware of human trafficking being the problem that it is in Iowa, across the nation. What types of understanding are just wrong when we think about this problem? Alex?
Well, yes, there is, I guess, an overlap, according to people's conceptions, with other crimes and also activities like illegal immigration, for example, or prostitution. Prostitution itself, as Denise mentioned, is not doesn't make somebody a victim. Currently, it's illegal. But people's conception about trafficking is that this happens in other parts of the world, or in case of Iowa, that this happens in larger cities, not in Iowa. And the people that live in the larger cities think that this happens in other parts of the world, not in the United States. It's such a when they see a movie or a story about human trafficking, sounds so bad that it's hard to believe that it happens so much to the extent that it happens. So there's some degree of denial until you actually see that it's happening in your own neighborhood, or that you see the news that it's happening in a rural area where many people grew up and these type of situations were unheard of. Mm-hmm. So people, I guess, they have to realize the magnitude of this. And although this doesn't come in front of the news, all the cases that we come across with and all the victims that result from this, that it is there. And it is a very degrading problem for society knowing that it exists, mm-hmm. because it is a slavery again.
Now, I want to go to our caller. Janet is joining us. Janet is on the road. We have just a minute or two left. Janet, what do you have to chip into our conversation?
Well, hello. I've gotten this information from a group called EPCAT, and I believe it's End Child Prostitution and Trafficking. And there's a code of conduct that was started by, I believe, Marianne Carlson, the founder of Carlton Hotels, where people in the hospitality industry are encouraged to sign this code of conduct where they agree to train hotel employees to recognize signs of trafficking and they're required to report it. Now, currently, I believe it's well prescribed to in Europe, but many American companies have not signed on, and I think that's a real important fact to get the
okay.
Hospitality industry on board.
Janet, we have little time left. You brought up an important point with which to end our discussion. What types of suspicious behavior should people be on the lookout for? This discussion leads me to believe it's happening on our doorstep. What should you look out for in your neighborhood that may indicate human trafficking?
Well, some of the things you can look for, especially when you're in the smaller towns, which has been the case in the cases that I have had, do you see some teenage girls walking around that you don't know who belong to? Does your town have a strip club? And you know, when I train officers, I tell them this. If your town has a strip club, you have human trafficking going on. It's just a given. Looking for, in regards to the labor, you know, looking, are there certain restaurants where you're seeing a high turnover of individuals? Or are you seeing large vans or buses bringing people through? Different things like that. And it's one of those things where it doesn't hurt to make a phone call to the police department to say, hey, you know, I've seen this going on a lot, or I've seen these two girls walking around and I don't know who they belong to. Just call it in. Report it.
Okay, so that's what you should do. Contact law enforcement. Probably never involve yourself would be a good rule.
Right. Contact law enforcement.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to thank you both. We've run out of time. Denise Timmons, Assistant Attorney General at the Iowa Attorney General's Office. Thank you, Denise.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Alex Orozco is Executive Director of the Iowa-based organization Network Against Human Trafficking. Thank you, Alex, for joining our conversation.
Thank you, Ben. It was a pleasure.
The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. And we want to thank Des Moines' John Pemble for help today. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. If you would like a podcast of this program or on-demand audio, it's available or will be shortly on our website, iowapublicradio.org. And we always welcome your comments, questions about this program. Perhaps you'd like to suggest a topic that we would address in a future program. Contact us anytime at the following email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.